Hey everybody, we'd like to give a special shout out to our podcast sponsor, Racketter Scents and Lures. Like Hunt, Lift, Eat, Racketter Scents is a veteran-owned and operated company with a personal touch. Gerard, their owner, is a former Marine and firefighter who will walk you step-by-step through the buy-in process with a personal touch. I reached out to him and he gave me his personal cell phone number and walked me through his products, and the buying experience could not have been more efficient. My favorite product of his is the Hot to Trot Dough and Heat scent, and I use it religiously through the rut with consistent results. Many of our Hunt, Lift, Eat team members are loyal customers of Racketter Scents and Lures, and we use this product year after year to help them execute in the field. Follow them on their Instagram at RacketterScents 2.0 and check out their products at RacketterScents.net to start luring in your next big buck.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Hunt, Lift, Eat podcast, brought to you by Hunt, Lift, Eat Official. I'm Carter McKenzie, joined by a couple usual suspects here tonight. I got Bobby coming at us from New Jersey. What's going on, Bobby?
What's going on, Carter? How are we tonight?
We're good, man. This is a solid Monday night here. Wrapped up a miserable day at work on this Monday and been looking forward to this one all day. Good way to round out the week here, bounce out the day. And Scotty's back. What's up, Scotty?
Here I am.
He's back.
Live in the flesh. I'm back.
Live in the flesh.
Happy to be back with the crew.
Heck yeah. Bobby and I had a bit of a panic right before we jumped on this call. I was actually logged out from too many password attempts from our RSS feed, so I can't post any podcasts. And I was about to text Luke and be like, hey, the podcast isn't coming out tomorrow. I'm sorry, man. It's the first one I failed on since having this job. And then Bobby found the support number and sent me a change or a password reset email. And he's like, check your email. So thank God we're back in. So now we're good to go.
Yeah. Sweet. I heard the panic in your voice when you called me. I was like, oh man, Carter fucked up.
Yeah, dude, I was pretty disappointed. I think it's because I tried to get you to log in New Jersey and it didn't like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just like no one's logging in from this shit from New Jersey. What the fuck's going on here? Yeah.
It didn't like that at all. Yeah. But it doesn't matter. We're back. And we have an awesome guest tonight. We're joined by our first taxidermist on the podcast here, actually. New buddy of mine, Drew Gann from North Georgia. Owner operator of Georgia Outdoorsman Taxidermy. So Drew, thanks for jumping on with us tonight, man.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Heck yeah. It's nice to have a fellow North Georgian round out this podcast here, man. We're few and far between around here.
Yeah.
We're spread to the four corners of the earth. But yeah, nothing wrong thanks for that. Jumping on, man.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Yeah, dude, I can't believe I didn't think about this earlier, but like obviously taxidermy makes a lot of sense for what this company does and what these listeners, you know, follow and I guess something that we save towards to, you know, help, I guess, hold on to memories from various hunts and adventures and things like that. And yeah. I can't believe we didn't make this happen earlier. So finally making it happen.
Glad to be your first.
Yeah, man. And we got, you know, Scotty, of course, had to be on here because he's obsessed with all dead things and all memorabilia accompanied with those dead things. So, Scotty.
Of course. I'm just so you know, Drew, I'm just a DIY European mount guy. That's what I do. I mean, gotcha. I help my buddies out. I like doing all my stuff. But I'm looking forward to, you know, hearing what you have to say. And because I always wonder like, oh man, what would it be like to actually make this kind of, you know, this somewhat of a passion into a profession, you know? And I know that things change when that happens a little bit. Definitely looking forward to picking your brain on some of that.
Sure. Yeah. I'll start off by saying more power to you for doing skulls, man. I don't miss doing those things at all.
Yeah. I get halfway through each set and I'm just like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this to myself? I mean, because they are time consuming, man.
Time consuming, it can be very dirty, especially if you don't know if you pressure wash yours. Do you pressure wash them?
I do.
Man, that's a dirty job.
It is a dirty job. My dogs, I mean, they come back around from the side of the house. I do my best to clean up, but there's just no way you can clean up everything. And they come and, first of all, they have nasty breath. They're little dogs. They have nasty breath to begin with. And then they come try to give me some love. And I'm like, I know where you've been, you know, digging through the soil and nasty cartilage breath. You know, it's gross.
Yeah, I can relate because I flush all my deer hides myself, and I pressure wash them. Mm-hmm. And I pressure wash outside, like you said, leaves a mess. And the first year, I was like, my dog, same thing, two dogs, they were always going and getting in it. So I took some fence and fenced the area around that I pressure wash where they can't get to it. So I had to put a stop to that. So
I can relate. Yep. I'd be doing the same thing for sure. I mean, I need to do something because it's a mess. And then, gosh, you know, I don't know if I stabbed my finger. I don't know what I did, but I was working on these skulls for a couple of days, and then I had my finger started getting really red and hot and infected. I'm like, oh God, I wonder, I've been dealing with all this rancid meat, you know, and I was just like, I hope my tetanus shot is up and I hope I'm good to go now. But, and then I had a big hunt last weekend that I was getting ready to go to. And I just was like, I need to go get this checked out, make sure I'm not in hunting camp and feeling like my finger's going to fall off, but I'm all good now. So you guys don't need to worry. Okay. Don't worry. I'm all good now, but it is a dirty mess. But so what do you mostly specialize in, Drew? Tell us a little bit.
Feathers is the lane I've picked is to focus on feathers. So ducks and some turkeys, but ducks is kind of my, like I said, my specialty, what I'm trying to focus on. So I do a few deer. Where I came from, I worked for a taxidermist full time for about 5 years, and I left to do, he doesn't do any feathers. And so I left to mostly do what he doesn't do because I'm only like 15 minutes from him. So just to be respectful and, you know, I didn't want to compete with him or anything and or burn any bridges. So feathers, and I love doing feathers. So it's worked out pretty good for me. I'm just coming up on 2 years of opening my business. So.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, man. I appreciate it.
I don't know when I came across your page, Drew. I think someone shared it in one of those hunting forums for Georgia, like hunting in the Georgia Piedmont or something like that. Yeah, yeah. Someone must have shared your name. And I came across it. I took a look at it. I was like, oh, like younger guy, like closer to my age than 60, right? I can talk with this guy. And your website was really well put together, and your photography is excellent on your finished pieces that you post on social media. You had a tightened up kind of look to your company. And I was like, oh yeah, like, you know, this is worth checking out. Like, and you're only 45 minutes up the road for me.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Yeah. I think, everything I do, the website, like you said, it's a representation of me. So I try to take everything seriously as I can.
Yeah, for sure. So you said you were doing this for 5 years prior. How'd you get into that? At all,
man, randomly, really. I had caught a trout that I wanted to get mounted and took it to the previous taxidermist as a customer, really dropped it off to get mounted. And while I was there, just got to talking with him. And I was working full time at Lowe's at that point. And I was like, I was working the night shift so I could have, you know, had extra time in the day. And I was like, are you looking for any help by chance? And he's like, actually, yeah, I'm looking for somebody to do my finish work. And I was like, well, I have zero experience in taxidermy. I was like, I have a little bit of artistic to me. And he's like, well, we can come in and try it out. And I worked part-time for about, I guess, not quite a year. And then he offered me a full-time position. So, yeah, it was really random. But I've always grew up hunting and fishing. So outdoors has always been a passion of mine. But taxidermy never was really on my radar, per se. So, but it, like it worked, like I said, it worked out. Here I am 7 years later and doing my own thing. So kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was going to ask what was your relationship with kind of the outdoors growing up? Did you grow up in North Georgia?
Nope. Grew up in South Georgia. So I'm originally from Tifton. So real far south. Yeah. I grew up with my dad running a deer processing plant in South Georgia. And then my grandfather had a small farm in South Georgia with a pond and some woods. So I grew up around, like I said, hunting and fishing. It's everything I can remember. I remember getting off the bus in elementary school at the processing place and helping my dad. Well, the most a 6 year, 7 year old can do, you know, helping him mostly eat things. Let's just be honest. I was mostly eating the sausage and stuff, but yeah. So it's just always been, it's in my blood, you know, people say that, but it truly is.
That's awesome. And you're clearly an avid outdoorsman. You're hunt fish, shoot ducks, shoot everything. Yeah.
If there's a season for it, I'm down for it.
That's awesome.
So Drew, you specialize in feathers, which is, seems like a difficult task to undertake, you know? And so what, for us as hunters, what can we do if we shoot a bird that we want to get mounted, what can we do or what should we do in preparation to, you know, give it to you? Cause I've heard of guys keeping birds for years, you know, in the freezer and whatnot. Probably not the, maybe the best idea, but, you know, if I go out and shoot a bird and I want you to do it up for me, how would you want me to kind of package that up?
You can throw me under the bus here, Drew.
I'm not throwing anybody under the bus here, but I recently had somebody that brought me a mallard duck that had been in the freezer for, I believe he said 4 years or more.
And it was probably 5 years. Probably
five years, maybe. Yeah. It was toast. So what's going to happen is if you don't properly prepare your bird for the freezer, it can get freezer burnt fairly quick. And what's going to happen when it gets freezer burnt is the feet and the head will be the first thing to go. And when they get freezer burnt, I can't skin the head off. So I can't skin it. I can't mount it. And then the feet get freezer burnt to where I can't rehydrate them or position them and make them look normal. The best way to prepare a bird is, it's super easy, is get three paper towels and get them soaking wet. One around each foot and then one around the head and the bill, and just stick that in a bag, a Ziploc bag, garbage bag. If it's a big duck, obviously a garbage bag, and just get all the air out you can and take it in the freezer. And just those paper towels being wet is going to give you months to years in the freezer. I mean, when I have them brought to me, if I don't skin them right away, like if I was to pull birds out of my freezer right now, you'd see I have them wrapped up and just like that, because it's just going to make them last so much longer. But don't put them in pantyhose. That's the old school way people put in pantyhose. What it's going to do, that compression of the pantyhose is going to compress those feathers to where at some point I can't put them back in the normal position. It's not going to look right. Don't vacuum pack them. That's even worse than pantyhose. Don't just stick them in a Walmart bag and throw them in the freezer. I mean, just, but I tell people, take care of it. If you want to look good, take care of it. It's easy to get it prepped. It really is. Just take a couple seconds and do it right. And even when you're picking your bird you're going to mount, I mean, I'm going to get on a soapbox here, so if you need to throw a timeout at me, but when you're picking a bird to mount, I know sometimes you get a rare bird, like if it's banded or a pintail or once in a lifetime bird, you might have the opportunity to pick and choose. But if you're going to pick one like a wood duck or mallard, something that's common, take a few seconds, open them wings up, look at them. Are they in good shape? Are they full of pin feathers? Because those pin feathers are going to come out when I'm mounting it. But in condition, this goes a long way with any kind of taxidermy. Condition says a lot. So if you can pick and choose, like I said, take a second, open them feathers up. Did you put a giant hole in it? I mean, I've had them bring me ducks that have been like half of their face has been shot off. So, and I tell them, like, I'll mount it. It's your bird. It's your dollar. I'll gladly mount it. But you see what I'm working with here. So, you know, I try to be upfront and honest with folks that if you want it to look good, pick out a good looking bird. Mm-hmm.
So. Now, since you specialize in birds, I got to ask, how many dog bites did you patch up throughout your years of doing this? I feel like my dogs destroy the birds.
That's a good question. I have not had to do a lot of that. I really haven't. I've had one that had some broken wing feathers, and I was able to position. I can position it sometimes to hide the damage, but I really haven't had to do a lot with that. And so, which is surprising, because you know, you think they're going to send that dog out there, and he's just going to, because a lot of times they're not dead when the dog brings it back, and the dog's just going to ham on that thing. So I haven't had big issues with that yet. I really haven't. Fortunately, knock on wood, that doesn't change.
It's going to start now. It's coming. Right? Yeah.
Domino effect. It's going to go crazy now.
You don't have a bird from Bobby's dog, Sarge, apparently.
Yeah, I've had all my dog's first birds mounted, and my one dog, Sarge, he destroyed this bird. And the guy looked at me, he's like, what the fuck do you want me to do to this? I was like, well, I guess we can make like a pelt out of it or something. He goes, I don't even think we'll get a feather. So I was always curious.
Yeah, a lot of times with those kind of things, you can do it. The dead mounts, you know, are getting real popular. And those are great when you have damage to a bird.
Yeah.
Because it kind of goes along with the story, you know?
I saw you post some of those today. I'd never seen that before. They look really cool.
Oh, man, they're getting so popular. They really are.
Which yeah, I'm looking at them right now on your page. It's really cool. It's actually a pretty cool way to display the feathers and their secondaries.
Yeah, you can position them in, you know, a couple of different ways when it comes to dead mounts. You know, you want to make it look natural as you can, but yeah, like I said, they're getting real popular.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I'm with you there with the bird mounts are probably like, I have a lot of taxidermy in my basement. I think my bird mounts are my favorite because the detail inside every feather, inside the wingspan, inside the beak, and it's just, I mean, it's got to be tedious for you to get everything perfect and prepared right. And every time I walk by, like even my pheasant mounts, I'm counting the black lines and the feathers and everything. I just think the detail in all those birds are beautiful.
Yeah, I totally agree, 100%. I've told multiple people that, you know, that I enjoy doing all the taxidermy. Ducks are always my favorite. Deer are fine. I'll mount a deer. It's fine. But deer become redundant, I guess you could say, because it's a left turn, a right turn, or upright, or straight. You know, there's only so much you can do. You can add details to make it, but as far as the positioning, it's different. But with a duck, sky's the limit. I can change that thing in all kinds of positions. So I like the creativity behind it. And yes, the details, I have a pair of tweezers, and when I have that bird mounted, I'm picking the feathers and putting them in place one by one. I mean, I can go cross-eyed. But the detail behind it is what makes that duck look beautiful to me. So, and it's still new to me, so I'm still loving it, but I can't see that changing anytime soon either.
Bobby, you really come from the world of feathers out of at least the three of us, man. Is like mounting pheasants, like full body mounts for pheasants, a big thing?
For me, it is because, you know, having three German Shorthair pointers, I upland hunting is a passion of mine. And I just feel like my whole house is all about pointers and upland hunting. And like I said before, the detail inside pheasants and quails and chucker and all those birds, I just love that they're such beautiful mounts. And the cool thing about them is where I could have my three deer heads up, I could probably have 10 or 15 bird mounts going in that same little spot. So I can have more birds versus, you know, a couple deer. My turkey mounts take up half my basement. And I think having those actual pheasants are so cool to really... And every one of them has a story with my dogs. I mean, I put the shotgun shell next to them, and I know exactly what day I got them.
Pheasants are gorgeous birds. You can't beat a pheasant for colors.
Exactly, yeah. You got some interesting mounts, like you said. Like, you can, like, the sky's the limit. I got some on driftwood, and then I did a couple. I have a couple, like, the pelts off, and they, like, glued them down to, like, flat wood, barnyard shutter or something like that. It's, like, interesting stuff, so... Like I said, you can't do that with a deer, which is really neat that you can do this kind of stuff with the birds.
Yeah. And they're getting creative with deer mounts. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the pack mounts are getting pretty popular. Have you seen those?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're getting more stuff with the deer, but I just think you can't. The creativity with a duck is just, or any, like you said, pheasant, turkey, you just can't compare the two in my books. So that's funny. I have a GSP. She's not a hunting dog. She's just a house dog, but. That's a special breed,
man. I knew I liked you.
Yeah. That's a special breed, though, man. Good Lord.
Yeah, seriously. And I used to have one, too. Have one. I mean, I couldn't hang, man. I couldn't do it.
I don't think I'll have another one because her name's Cabela. She's, I think she's coming up on 12 now, and she has not slowed down that much.
Oh, my gosh. So you're saying made the right decision then, I think.
Yeah, I've told my wife. I love her, but this is the last GSP we're going to get because I can't handle it.
But they're good. I hope my wife doesn't hear this podcast. Oh my God. Like, I told you. I fucking told you.
It explains a lot about Bobby.
Yeah, my poor wife is the only dog she's ever had. So
Bobby is a other dog.
Yeah. We all mesh together.
Yeah. She probably says the same thing about you, too.
Oh, 100%. That's probably the best thing she says about me is probably that.
Yeah. He's the only thing I know, so I better keep him around.
Yeah, that's funny.
Now, do you get a chance to hunt a lot, Drew? Or do you hunt with your GSP? Or maybe in the 12, maybe a bit old, but do you get a chance to go out a lot? Or are you stuck there working on all those antlers I saw hanging up?
I'm fortunate. I have a small tract of land here at my house that I can hunt here at my house. I was actually hunting this evening before we got on the podcast. So I can walk out my backyard and, you know, I can see a fair amount of deer. But and then I try to take one trip a year just to kind of get away and reset. I try to go to Kentucky every year and I go up to Land Between the Lakes, big public land up there. So I'm going up there November 9th. So, yeah, I try to get away. I don't want to burn myself out, you know. You got to have that little release, get out there and enjoy the nature that you do this for. So,
I totally understand that.
Yeah.
I think that's really important, too. That's my big mantra to everybody is, you know, take the trip, right?
Yeah.
You're only going to be this age once. So take the trip. True. Go enjoy it.
Yeah. Very true.
Now, will you mount your own deer? Will you mount your own birds?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Does it take you twice as long? Do you get nitpicky over your birds or your deer?
Well, typically my stuff takes a backseat. I've got a turkey. I shot an Osceola. I think, it's been coming up on 3 years now, and I have intentions to full body mount it, but my stuff takes a backseat to customers. So, but I will eventually mount it. But I guess I'm probably a little less picky with my stuff than I am customers, actually. Because I can hide mine if I don't like it.
Yeah, right.
Where a customer, they're taking it home with them. Like, you know, we were saying, that's a memory. So I'm probably more picky with customer stuff. So.
You better get it done or it's going to sit in your freezer for 5 years like my duck, Drew.
Well, I properly stored it, Carter, so I'm good.
So Drew, I got a question for you. You mentioned that you were dropping off I think you said a bird and a fish, right? The trout. And so that guy kind of took you under his wing and probably taught you everything under the sun that he knew. I know there's a lot of taxidermy schools out there. Does a guy like you need to go to a school in order to get certified to do what you do?
Is not required by no means, no. There's multiple ways of doing it, really. You have to have a state license, which anybody can apply for. As long as you don't have a game violation, you can get a license. It's a couple $100. My license is right here. Lasts for about 3 years, I think. And then if you're going to do ducks, you have to have a federal license. And that you can't be a felon or anything. And federal license takes a little bit longer to get, a little bit more of a hassle because it's federal. But again, that's only for ducks. But as far as learning it, you can do what I did. Just go to another taxidermist, you know, get underneath their supervision. They'll teach you everything they know. You can do the schools. I know Georgia has a Georgia Taxidermy Association. It's open to anybody, can be a member. And they do a convention once a year, and they'll go and do classes, how to mount a duck, how to mount a deer from start to finish. And that would be a lot less inexpensive than a school, because I haven't done the schools. I've seen them, and they seem to be pretty pricey for just a few days. I think, and you may have seen more than I have, but ones I've seen are like 4 or 5 days, and it's a couple $1,000s. Well, 4 or 5 days is not going to show you everything. I mean, like I said, I did it for 5 years and I'm still learning to this day. So, I mean, you never stop learning, but if you were going to do it, my recommendation would be find the taxidermist is willing to teach you. That's just the best way to do it, I think. even if it's just part time for years, you know. And then you can do, you know, DIY, you know, just give it a shot, see if you like it. I've had a few guys do that, and I tell them, if you're going to start, do a squirrel. There's thousands of them out there, easy to come by. The form and stuff is pretty inexpensive to get. So it's just an easy one to, it's easy to flash. It's just easy all around. And it kind of gives you that little insight as to whether or not you're going to like mountain animals or not. So it's a great one to start with, I think.
So yeah, that's great advice.
Yeah.
That's a great tip.
That is good advice. I was talking to a buddy and I was like, hey man, in that preparation for that mule deer hunt I was telling you about, Drew, next month.
Yeah.
I was like, hey man, I've never caped an animal before and we're going to be back in there. And he was like, don't have your first one be on that mule deer that you want to get mounted. He's like, practice on does, practice on all the does first. Yeah. And then, you know, learn the ins and outs of it. Cause you know, you can mess up there. It's a little more forgiving versus when you get to that actual trophy that you want to bring back and maintain.
Mm-hmm. And with deer, it's a little bit easier to hide. I guess what you call it, a mistake as far as to hide, especially if they have longer hair. So it's easier to hide that, but yeah, you definitely want to practice on something. If you go out there and you shoot a trophy, you don't want to get in the backwoods and totally mess it up. So yeah, like I said, like your friend said, a doe or a small buck or any buck around here, you know, it'd be a great practice. Or heck, if you get bored one day, come to the shop. I'll let you practice on some deer up here.
There you go.
I'll supervise you though.
Right. I need supervision.
There you go. Yeah.
Now, how do you stay like on top of your game, right? Last time I was there, you were showing me that gigantic textbook of things that a taxidermist can order with everything under the sun in there, from whatever replaceable, you know, fake Euro mount skulls to pedestals to, I mean, it was overwhelming how much stuff was in that book. How do you stay on top of your game and like continue? Because you're an artist, right? Like you want to continue to get better and better. Like how do you think about that, or how do you approach that every season?
Sure, yeah, great question. I mean, stay on top of it. It's a constant, because that catalog you saw is one company, and I'm mostly using McKenzie Taxidermy. They're probably, I'd say they're one of, if not the biggest taxidermy supply company in the USA. But they have a new catalog every year, and it's literally, I mean, it is, you saw it. It's like, it's ridiculous. It's
a couple. It was overwhelming.
Yeah. It is. And like you said, they have everything under the sun as far as taxidermy supply goes. If, I mean, you name it, I can probably find it in that catalog. If they don't have it, another company is going to. So it's just like, I find myself some days, like if, you know, I get to a point where I'm done and it's kind of early, I literally find myself in that catalog just going through the pages, flipping through them, especially if I get a new one. Because a new one's supposed to be showing up anytime now. And they're new products every year. So I'll just find myself going through it like a magazine and just seeing what's new. But the company, they're really good about the first few pages. They'll put everything new in the catalog. So you kind of have an idea going up, you know, up front as to what's new and what's available. But, and then like everything else in the world, prices are changing. So you got to stay on top of that. So, you know, but as far, and like you said, as far as learning, I mean, I'll never stop learning. I'm always trying to, excuse me, there's several taxidermists that, as far as ducks go, that I look up to. And I'm constantly looking at their work. Like, you know, I've done a convention with a guy from Utah, come out to Georgia in a convention, and was just blown away at, you know, how his condition of his birds are just, to me, they're gorgeous, magnificent, you know, magnificent. I was just, it was breathtaking to see him do what he does, but he doesn't do it any different. It's just, well, he's been doing it for 25 years. So, you know, you're constantly getting better. So I'm hoping, you know, I'm 2 years in here. I'm hoping another 20 years or so I can, hopefully I'll be fortunate enough that somebody says, oh yeah, I saw Drew's work. It's amazing. So that would be a huge blessing for sure. But yeah, never stop learning. That's a thing I keep telling myself. If the day comes where I think I've got it figured out, that's the day it's time for me to quit.
Yeah, I feel like that applies to a lot of different things in life, and that's a good thing to live by. It makes a lot of sense. And speaking of, you know, never stop learning, Was I your first Axis antlers brought to you?
Yes. You were the first Axis deer I've ever worked on, even when I was at the other taxidermist. And he does, gosh,
all sorts of exotics.
1,000+ animals a year. Yeah. I mean, he's a huge operation. And yeah, I mean, African, I mean, all over, but never did an Axis deer. So you were the first Axis deer I've ever put my hands on. So that was a pretty cool experience for sure.
Yeah, that was new for me, the concept of cutting off the antlers in the field to be able to get it home. I'd never done that before.
Right.
Yeah, I've done that before. It made me a bit apprehensive. Yeah.
Yeah, I had to replace antlers before. So did you ship that back? I meant to ask. Did you ship it back?
I brought the antlers in my gun case, and then I vacuum sealed the skull and shipped it, like, post-service for $19. Shipped it to my house.
Can't beat that. All the way from Hawaii.
That was good. Because I was just nervous about it breaking or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I bowled it out there. I bowled it out in our condo, which not everybody was thrilled with.
I was about to say, I bet you make
sense. Yeah. But I knew with this new rule, people are weird about brains coming across state lines. So I knew I'd had to get the brain out.
Yeah, especially shipping it. Because I've had a customer ship me a hide. It was a deer, a friend of mine. He lives in Indiana. And shipped me a deer, shipped the hide separate from the antlers. And I told him to overnight the hide. And I think he overnighted, but didn't get here overnight. It was ruined.
Just went rancid.
Yeah. I didn't have to open the box. I could just smell it. I felt bad for the post lady, you know. She had to drive around in her car. But
all day.
All day, yeah, because some cops. But yeah, it was just ruined. So I can understand, you know, the nervousness about that. But luckily, I was able to give him a new cape, so it worked out. But yeah.
So in one day, a hide can go bad in one day. Well, it was probably 2 days, right? But or maybe it also had to do with the condition it was like when he put it in the freezer to begin with. That's probably more so maybe the case. But needless to say, they can spoil pretty quick, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go involved with a hide. But yeah, if especially a little bit of sunlight can just go a long way. And it also depends on how you shot it. If you gut shot it and that stomach, the inside of that stomach rupture and that stomach acid gets up in the body in the cavity or it gets on some of the skin, it's just going to slip. So there's so many factors going to, I know I did a deer last year and some of the hair was slipping on it and called the customer and said, "Hey man, your hair's kind of slipping a little bit. Just want to kind of give you a heads up." I was like, "I can keep going forward with it. It's going to have a little bit of character, you could say. If I can get you a new cape." He was like, "Well, why do you think it went bad?" I was like, "Well, let's back up. You know, when you shot it, did you recover it right away? Or was it a few hours or days?" He's like, "No, we found it the same night." I was like, "Okay, was it cold that night?" He's like, "Yeah, it was pretty cold." He's like, "We hung it up for 3 days." I was like, "Well, there's a small issue. If you let it hang for 3 days, even though it's cold, I mean, he was in Kentucky, you know, I was like, even though it's cold, it can still affect that cape. So the quicker you can get that thing on frozen, not just on ice, but frozen, makes a huge difference. Huge difference. Because I can, as soon as you get it to me, I can freeze it and I can prepare it and it'll last in my freezer for a long time, years. So yeah, there's just so many factors that can go involved with it, but treat your cape like you treat your meat. That's all I tell people.
Now, that's good advice.
If you get it off fast, do you, just roll it up and throw it in the freezer?
Yep. I just, I'll get it off the skull. And if they leave any big chunks of meat, I'll cut that off. Just getting that meat off, it just helps the actual cape freeze quicker. And then I have the clear plastic bags and just get all the air out of the can, label it and put it in the freezer. And I mean, like I said, they'll last for, you know, years. I mean, there's some taxidermists that, you know, they have 2-3 year turnaround time. So that cape's going to be fine once you get it. Okay. Yeah. Cause you're putting the ears and the face is inside the cape. It's like in the middle of everything. So that's the least, cause air is your worst enemy when it comes to freezer burn. So having it all tucked in there is going to save it and keep it good to mount in the future.
Hey y'all, I'm going to take a second to give a quick shout out to the official mortgage lender of the Hunt with Deep podcast. That's Casey Burns of Prime Lending Mortgage. I've known Casey for 10 years, and he's the only lender I use. I've used Casey to purchase 2 houses, and the process has been seamless and easy each time. He's the heart of an educator, and he truly cares about what's best for his clients. He specializes in VA loans, but can handle FHA, conventional, and investment loans as well. He's a true expert and specialist in his field, and there's no one I recommend more than Casey. You can contact Casey at casey.burns@primelending.com. Reach him by phone at 919-710-1864. You can also check out all his reviews at www.closewithcasey.com. Thanks, y'all.
Well, we went out this weekend and on a bear hunt. I've never been on a bear hunt before here in California. We were out there for about 3 days, and we got lucky. We were on a big hunt in the afternoon, and we were just hiking back. We were pretty smoked coming back to the boat, but we're probably a quarter mile from the boat, and my buddy pulled up and just let off a shot. They were ahead of me a little bit because I had stopped and I was glassing this hillside. And bear was just on the trail pretty much. And it, thank God, cause it was like the only place we could really shoot something. It was so thick in these other areas. But there's a bear 50 yards off the road. He hammered her and, she went down, you know, 10 yards from where he shot her, which was amazing. We got so lucky. And, all of us, he had shot one bear before, and my brother and I, not, you know, we've never shot a bear, and we've never really even seen a bear out in the wild before, other than, you know, camping up in Tahoe or something where it's fairly easy to see bears, but not hunting bears. And so we made a very valid effort to save that hide for a rug. And I think we did a pretty good job. I was lucky enough to watch some videos on how to kind of skin around the paws and break that ankle bone and get them pretty much intact. And, you know, trying my best to remember where to make these cuts and stuff. But it's something you need to kind of prep yourself before the hunt on what you're going to do if you get one of these trophy type animals down, whether it's a big buck or a bear or, you know, anything out there. How are you going to cape it? Are you going to try to make a rug? You really have to educate yourself beforehand. So, and we did it. It was, of course, like most hunts, you know, it got dark. We're tired. We finally got this bear back down to the shore. We gutted her. We did everything. We're just, you know, of course, when everything was said and done, all the knives flying and stuff, there's a couple pierces through the hide and everything. It's just like, oh my gosh, I hope it's good. I hope everybody's a little on edge when you're going to bring, everybody's just hoping the taxidermist is going to say, yeah, it's good. Same thing with your butcher too. When you bring your meat in, you're like, it's good, right? It's clean, right? It's clean. I know it's clean. We did everything we could. Once they say, yeah, man, you're good, you know, there's a lot of weight lifted off your shoulders that you finally did your job. But just like you're saying, man, it's good to kind of, that prep work in the field is huge if you're trying to save something for taxidermy purposes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And there's so many good resources online. I mean, YouTube videos to just, like you said, watch and learn, even call your taxidermist that you use and say, hey, I'm going out, you know, west to shoot a bear or whatever. What should I do? How do I do it? I can't think any taxidermist would tell you that they're not going to help you out, because you're helping them out in the long run. Because if you bring them a bad cape, like you were saying, that's more aggravation for them. So I've had customers come here and I'll show them how to, you know, cape a deer out or how to do this or that, so they can do it on the, you know, their self, do a DIY. Because like you said, if you're out, you know, in the middle of nowhere, your options are pretty slim. And then to go along with that, Georgia this year has new regulations that no deer outside of the state can be brought back in that hasn't been deboned, and no brain matter can be brought back in. So if I go to Kentucky and shoot a deer, I can't bring the whole head back. It has to be separated from the skull plate, and the brain's got to be removed, and all the meat has to be deboned. So, and I have several customers that hunt out of state, and so I actually filmed a little step-by-step process of how to cape your deer off the skull and put it up on YouTube. So if somebody ever calls or asks, I'm like, oh, here, watch this real quick. It's step-by-step process, and try to make it easy. And it's not difficult to do that, but it's just taking your time. Don't get in a hurry and make clean cuts. It kind of goes with everything. But a bear is a lot different. It's especially if you're doing a rug, man, because if you cut that one leg different than this leg. They're going to look unproportioned on the wall. So I could see where you're being real nervous about that. So, yeah, it's a job.
I don't even know if he's got enough money for the rug. Because what I've heard about rugs is they're like, I don't know, $300 from tip to tail or something like that, you know? So yeah. You shoot a 7-foot bear, you know, you got a couple grand coming out of your bank account barely, you know, when it's done. Yeah. So, you know, we made the effort for it, but, you know, taxidermy, you know, if you want really good quality stuff, you know, you're going to pay for it.
That's very true. Yeah, that's exactly where I used to work. He does bears, and I believe he went up this year, but his prices for rugs, that's closed mouth now. It's $300 from the tip of the nose to the base of the tail. And if it's open mouth, I think it's like $350 or $400 a foot. So, yeah, it can, any bear mount, it can get expensive real quick, especially like you said, if you shoot a big bear. So I've never killed a bear, but I've always heard once you shoot one and pack it out, that'd be the last one you do. Would you agree?
You know what? It's so amazing. Well, we were real lucky. We were only a quarter mile downhill, a downhill drag, quarter mile to the boat. And so we had it so easy, but we were talking about it that night by the campfire. We're like, could you imagine if we would have shot a bear off the trail, even? Where, like, when we were way back in there, you know, and there's a lot of, we weren't too far in, but there's a lot of vertical feet between, you know, the water's edge and where we were at. And every bear hunting YouTube video I've watched, it looks miserable. You know, they are dying in every single bear hunt. It's like always at night. They always have real heavy loads. And I don't think there's anything easy about a bear hunt in general. And so, they're just difficult. So if we got really lucky, if we were way back there, it would have been a completely different story. Not only that, like for someone that, like, I know it changed my perspective. We got back to camp and I'm like, man, I don't even know. It was like, that was Friday night and we were leaving on Sunday. I was like, I don't even know if I want to shoot a bear now after how much work that one was, you know, but, of course I would have if I had the opportunity, but, no, man, it's tough hunts and the size of that, basically, you know, the hide of that bear with the head on it, man, that's a load in itself. I mean, it was a decent sized bear. I want to say she was probably 350, maybe. Oh. He's definitely 350 pounds, I think. But, you know, but it was a big hide. I mean, it was a learning experience for all of us, but man, the pack out would have been very difficult if we would have got one way in there.
Yeah, and 350 is not decent size. That's a big bear. I mean, at least for Georgia, that's a big bear.
That's a big bear.
No, it was a big bear. I was amazed at how big it was, you know. Yeah. But and it was one of those things where it just got bigger walking up to it, surprisingly. And me never seeing a dead bear like that, it was like, whoa, I couldn't believe it. I guess my brother's a pretty big dude, and I got a video. Like, thank God, again, we were dragging downhill, but he's a pretty big dude dragging this bear down. It's like, oh, my goodness. They are wild beasts for sure. And I definitely looking forward to getting out and trying it again probably next year. But it was a fun time. For me, if I do get one, I'm just going to lop the head off. I just want the skull and, of course, the meat. and then there's no way I'm carrying that hide out. And then we cut off a bunch of fat and everything. We're going to try to render it down. And she was super fat too, which is part of her size.
Have you got to eat any of it yet, the bear meat?
We cooked a little bit of it up in camp just over the fire. And then we cooked we used some of the fat for some like sauteed mushrooms and onions and stuff. And it was really good though. It was tasty. You know, of course we made sure we cook it. We're all, you know, of course worried that we're going to get trichinosis or something from eating it, but as long as it's cooked through, it should be fine, right?
Yeah, I know.
That's right. I'm okay, right?
Scotty is going pale.
Yeah, right. I'm starting to sweat a little bit.
I've had multiple people where I used to work with did bears. They'd bring the bear in and be like, you know, they don't want the meat because they couldn't stand it. But I would take it and have it processed because I think bear meat's delicious, which I guess is anything you cook. If you cook it right, it's good, but I think it's very good meat.
Yeah, I was impressed by it. It was tasty, and I could see how you can go. I mean, I don't know how would you normally do it? I mean, would you do mostly grind with it, or do you do steaks with it?
Both. I guess the processor then did what they call a standard cut. So you get a little bit of, you get some bone-in ribeyes, like shoulder ribeyes, I guess, and then a bunch of ground and then cubes. And so, I mean, everything, all the cuts I've had have been just very good. I mean, done, you know, burgers, just any, if it's ground meat, if you put enough seasoning in it and cook it through, it's going to be fine. Yep. But the steaks were good, I thought. I mean, you know, so I've always thought it was delicious. Somebody tells me they try to bury it, it's gross. I'm like, you're crazy. It's delicious meat.
The best chili I ever had was bear chili. And I don't know why it was so good, but I had it years ago. And I was like, still to this day, I'm like, man, bear chili was the shit. And now it just doesn't compare to some other things. I don't know. Maybe because it was so fatty. No idea.
Your state doesn't let people shoot bears anymore, right, Bobby?
No, we, our lovely governor deemed the state, you know, let's not talk politics, but yeah, we don't have a bear hunt anymore in this state, thanks to our, but we do have a lot more bear attacks right now on poor little fluffies around the neighborhood and people.
Oh my goodness.
The logistics of this is just dumb.
Is that new for your state?
Ever since we got this new governor, yeah, he stopped the bear hunt. And New Jersey, I mean, we have great black bear hunting here. Like, we have Bear Mountain everywhere. And I remember the first time I went deer hunting with my dad, we were coming up in Sussex County around Bear Mountain. I go, why do they call it Bear Mountain? It's just like a lot of bears here. And we're at a red light and like four bears are just crossing the fucking highway. Oh, wow. It's just no big deal, man. I'm like, all right, got it. Now noted for next time.
Clear. Yeah. That's crazy.
Would you say that's one of the more difficult animals to work on, Drew?
It's depends on what aspect you're looking at. It's fairly easy to, that's a good question. It's fairly easy to mount. They're pretty tough to flesh, but they're not as tough to flesh as a wild hog. Because a wild hog is probably the hardest thing to flesh because of that shield. You know? It's just so tough. Makes sense. So it just depends on what aspect you're looking at. I don't think it's the hardest to do now.
Yeah. Well, I got a question for you, Drew. Sure. Well, I probably have a lot of questions. They're all, but if a guy's going to do a hide on his own, you know, like I shot a squirrel when I was probably like 12, and my uncles showed me how to skin it out, and we put it on a piece of plywood and stretched it out and salted it up, and it I don't know where it is now, but it cured a super hard, you know. Can guys do their own kind of mini taxidermy hides at home? And once it gets to that salted hard crisp point, what can we do to make it more pliable?
Yes, you can definitely do it yourself. Talking about like soft tan hides on anything, there's so many ways to do it, but it's very easy to do as long as you have the time and the space to do it if you're doing something big. So I don't do tans. I don't soft tan hide anything. I always ship it out or have somebody else do it because of the space. But once you get it salted, if you leave it on salt for a few days until it gets all that moisture out, then you're going to put it in a pickle. And that pickle is going to basically soften it back up, and it's going to have acid and degreaser and odor eliminator and a few other salt and water, of course. But that pickle is going to rehydrate it and preserve that skin where the hair won't fall out. And then you're going to put basically like leather oil on it or tanning oil on it. And it's going to get hard at that point when you put the tanning oil on it, but when it gets tan like that, you can take it and work it like a rag and get it super soft. I mean, we used to take them like a deer hide and you roll it up with the fur in where the skin's out and just find you a brick wall and just go to town and just make it super soft. So it's very easy to do. And there's even, I haven't messed with them. I've seen them. There's chemicals now, this process to where after you salt it and you wash all that soft off, it's just a spray bottle that you spray the skin, and that's supposed to tan it. I've never used it, but there's advancing so many different ways to do it. So it's definitely possible to DIY your own hides. Pretty easy too.
So I actually, I'm definitely going to try that out.
Yeah, I have a piebald deer guy shot. I got in, I guess, about a week ago, and it has a lot of white on it. It's a gorgeous deer. Tried to convince him to do a at least a some kind of mount, but he just wanted to tan the hide. But I'm fixing to get that process going. But I'm going to flesh it and get it all ready, and then I have somebody else that's going to tan it for me. So, yeah, it's easy to do. Like going back to the resources for skinning something out, there's so many resources to tan your own hide too online. So if you can't find it on YouTube, you probably shouldn't do it.
For real, right?
Yeah.
That was something you and I have talked about twice now. With I messaged you on the airplane on the way to Hawaii. And I was like, hey, man, if I shoot an axis, can you do it? And then you, when you and I talked about the mule deer, you said, yes, but what about the hides was different?
You want to wet tan those. So I don't wet tan any of my deer. I do what basically was a dry tan. I do dry preserves. And that's kind of a hot topic in the taxidermy community. But I do all dry preserves. I don't do wet tans because, again, it goes back to the space, having to salt that whole hide. I don't have the space right now in my shop to lay it out and salt it. So I can get it done, but I'll have to ship it off to a tannery. And it's just going to cost more. To where if you find the tax, like where I used to work, they do wet tans. They can do it in-house. And it's going to be a little bit more cost-effective for you. So there's all kinds of ways of doing it.
Yeah, I'd never heard that term before. I figured everything was very straightforward and didn't think, of course, there should be nuance when you're dealing with different animals in this world.
Yeah. And then some things you almost, some animals you almost have to wet tan. Just because of the type of hair. I know like an antelope, because their hair is very hollow and coarse and can fall out very easy. So you have to wet tan that because the dry preserve is almost not going to preserve that hide because of the type of hair they have. And the mule deer, I've only ever wet tanned them where I used to work. And so there's some things you have to wet tan to make sure that doesn't, hair doesn't start falling out in a few years once it's on your wall. And you call me one day saying, hey man, the hair's falling off my mount. What the heck? So we don't want that phone call.
No.
So, Drew, with the, you know, with technology nowadays, obviously, you know, we talked about like YouTube and there's so much access to information online within the taxidermy world, you know, those that are actually doing it, are there some like technological advances that you guys have that you're seeing maybe come into the industry that making your job a little bit easier, maybe compared to what it was, you know, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years ago for some of these old timer guys that have been doing stuff. Have there been any methods that have come up that have, you know, made life a little bit easier for you guys?
Yes, I can. 100% yes. Just in the short time I've done it, it's crazy how it's changed in the past, you know, 7 years. Talking about technological advances, I have a machine or system here that if you, I've done it one time and I was amazed how it turned out. Basically, if you shoot a deer, this guy shot a deer in Georgia opening weekend. It was in full velvet. He didn't find it until after season. So when he found it, the antlers were snow white, you know, just of course no velvet on it. And I put it back in velvet and you would have no idea that it was fake velvet. If you saw it, I had multiple hunters come in here and say, oh, it's a gorgeous velvet deer. You know, it looks great. I'm like, yeah, the velvet's fake. And they're all like, what? I'm like, yeah, it's fake velvet. But the way you can put it on is I basically put a charge to the antlers, like electricity charge, to where when, and I sprinkled the velvet on there. So when it hit the glue on the antlers, it stood up versus if I didn't have it charged, it would just lay down flat. So just the fact that
that's exists, wild.
I was just like, cause they were at the convention this past year and at the taxidermy convention, this company, they were showcasing it. And I was like, that's who would have thought to do that? It's amazing. So yeah, the advancements, even the forms alone, what, you know, they look like now to what they used to look like 20, 30 years ago. Cause I have a mount from my grandfather killed back in the I want to say 60s. And even the forms alone just have come so far. I mean, you know, they used to be, I'm sure you've seen them, just the neck mount. It's basically like a foot behind the neck. And that's all they did. So where now, you know, you get half mounts, shoulder mounts, all kinds of mounts. But yeah, everything's constantly changing and advancing. And it can be overwhelming, but as long as you take it at strides, I think it's definitely a good thing. Because it's also going to make this taxidermy stuff last a lot longer. You know, I had a guy bring me four mounts the other day that I had to, like, basically give him some TLC. They were cracking and falling apart. He had a wild hog. And I think he said, Dad, he killed like 30 years ago, but the nose was literally just falling off the mount. So, and a lot of that has to do with upkeep. But it just makes things so much easier these days to make sure that this, you know, that memory is going to last for you. So, but yeah, taking care of your taxidermy work is another thing that people don't always think about. Once you get it home, it still takes a little TLC on your part too.
Yeah, absolutely. The work is not over mm-hmm. when you get home. You always got to take care of your meat, take care of your skulls, take care of your hides, take care of all of it if you want to last. For sure.
Yeah, two worst things for taxidermy is heat and sunlight. If you have a fireplace, you want to keep your taxidermy around it because that dry heat from that fireplace is going to make it crack and dry out in that skin. And then sunlight, it's just going to make it fade. So if you ever see a deer from like 30 years ago and it's like white, it's because it's been the sunlight or it's just lost its color. So yeah, heat and sunlight, you want to avoid that for your mounts. And then keep it like, you know, AC, don't put it out in your barn and expect it to look good in 20 years.
Yeah. Right.
So,
yeah. Well, it's cool that you brought up the velvet technology because I've seen some videos on that and it was so satisfying to watch almost, you know, because they just put a little layer. I think you put maybe a little layer of glue on the antler and then just dab that stuff on. And it was these real close up. Videos of it trying to show exactly how it works. It's really awesome how you can do that.
Yeah.
I'm actually working on my first velvet buck and I'm not having a heck of a time, but you know, trying to get this velvet, it sat in the freezer for like a year. I'm trying to, it's pretty much cured, but there's a little bit of an odor to it. And it's just in my garage right now. And I'm just like, man, how am I going to get rid of this? You know, because I want it to be good, you know, and then I'm going to shampoo it and blow dry it and try to make it look nice again once I'm done. But I'm trying to work on getting that odor to go away. And I don't know is that a sign that it's not completely cured yet?
Yes, there's still blood in there. That's why it stinks. Yeah. And they make something, and all of the stuff in this catalog that taxidermy supplies is accessible to anybody. You don't have to have a taxidermy license to buy it, but they make something called a velvet tan, and that's what I use to preserve all my velvet. It comes in a bottle, you get a syringe, and you're basically going to stick that syringe in the veins in the antler and just pump that antler full of that velvet tan, and it's going to push all that blood out, and then you're good. So yeah, that's why it stinks, is because there's still some blood in there, and it's probably still a little soft in some areas, and that's where that blood's going to be. But I do know people that stick them in freezers for years at a time and eventually it can cure, but then like in your case it's still got a little blood in it. There are a few ways of doing it, but yeah, there's even something called Velva Lock, and mm-hmm. if you've seen that, it's in a little spray bottle.
Yep, I've seen that.
Yeah, now I put that on after I use the velvet tan. Some people say they just spray it on directly and that's all they do, but I do the velvet tan to make sure I get all that blood out, and then I spray that Velva Lock on the outside because it's got citronella, keep the bugs and everything away from it. So yeah, it's a fairly easy fix for you. Just, you know, like I said, just look for that velvet tan and you should be able to fix that smell.
Yeah, I've seen those sprays around, and yeah, and that's the thing about taxidermy, and for those of us like DIY guys, you know, which it's probably most of us that are trying to just maintain their stuff, or, you know, it's not super hard to do a European mount, but it's all learning. I learn something new every set I go through, you know, and I'm starting to, you know, like this time I'm doing like five different things at one time, and it's hard to kind of, you know, for when you're used to doing one or two, and then you kind of add a couple more, and everything is time sensitive. You don't want something to overboil, you know, because that's what I'm doing. But it's a lot of work, man. But you pick up something new every single time that's going to help you in the future. And I think that's probably why you're so good at what you do, right?
Yeah, 100% agree. Because, you know, like you said, if you just, you got to enjoy it. You don't want to get burned out on it, but constantly learning and just taking your time. Don't get in a hurry with it, you know. Don't expect the instant gratification. It's just going to be clean in an hour or two. Because those skulls, man, like I said before, that stuff's work. I don't envy you at all having to do those things. Because it is a dirty job. But, yeah, just sticking with it and making sure you do it right. Like, have you done any kind of anything with horns on it? Like rams or anything like that?
Haven't done any. No antelope or rams or nothing with horns yet. But I kind of know what to expect when that day comes, you know. But I know they come off. I know that, you know, I follow one of these taxidermist guys that you're probably well aware of. And he has all these videos online to show how to do European mounts and how to handle horns. And he's drying them out inside. And, you know, but there's a lot of detail work that goes into these mounts. So,
mm-hmm. I know a lot of times the deer a lot of the animals in the past, when you boil them, the base of the antlers are going to lose color and we'll have to like repaint it, mm-hmm. and try to make it look, you know, as natural as possible. So yep. Even something as, I'd say in quotes, simple as a antler mount still involves a lot of technique behind it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes what you're doing so cool, Drew, and so important. Like, I mean, that technique and your work is like painstaking, right? I've never done it, but I know it has to be, right? And I know it can probably be really frustrating. And, you know, your job is like to preserve someone's memory of an animal that was obviously impactful enough for them to bring to you to try and preserve, to put somewhere that they love and appreciate, either to, you know, serve as memory of that story or, you know, that adventure they had or the people they were with, or like as a conversation starter. Cause like, I love telling stories about all my mounts I have around my place here, and I'll talk about them to anybody forever. And I think that's like, I don't know, having a good taxidermist in your corner is one of the most crucial parts, I think, of being an outdoorsman. And, you know, it can get kind of like, I don't know, people love to hate on the word trophy hunter and like trophies and like that kind of stuff. But like, you know, every mount I have is a trophy, and none of these deer are over 130 inches. So it's like, it's not like I'm killing big giant 180 inch whitetails like a lot of people, but you know, each one is a trophy in its own respect because of the people I was with and, you know, trying to preserve that story and that memory. And yeah, I think what you're doing is really important, man.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, it's that old saying, the trophy's in the eyes of the beholder, you know. I've done several kids' first deer, or, you know, and that's something you'll always have the chance to shoot a bigger buck, but you'll never be able to replace your first. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure or weight on my shoulders when they come and get their animal that, you know, I want them to be happy with it. You know, I don't want them, because if I do a good job, they're going to tell a couple of their buddies. If I do a bad job, they're going to tell everybody quickly. So bad news spreads quicker than good news, of course. But yeah, it's definitely, I love doing it. It's a lot of pressure, but I try to take my time in doing it. And for anybody that, you know, you're looking for a taxidermist, my only recommendation is don't look at their price. Some guys are looking for the cheapest, you know. And that's not always the best. It's like you said, Carter, it's a memory that you're going to be telling forever. It's like, you know, I've seen the memes, you know, a deer hunter, $80,000 truck, $10,000 UTV, $12,000 lease, $100 in corn, but complains about spending $400 on a shoulder mount that he spent thousands of bucks to kill his deer. Yep. So it's just, you know, do your research. Look at their work. Whoever you decide to use, me or anybody, just look at their work. Is it good quality stuff? You know, get your money's worth. Make it last.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important relationship to have. And you live in a cool, you work within a cool space in this world, this outdoor hunting world. And It's cool to kind of see behind the curtain for a minute and see what you're working with and what you go through. So,
yeah, but, no, it is very cool because everybody that walks in that shop is always in a good mood.
Yeah.
I've never had an unhappy customer walk in the door because they're always super excited. They killed a big deer or an awesome duck. So that's one great thing about this is they're always in a good mood when they come in the door. So I get happy customers all the time. And so far, knock on wood, in the 2 years, they've always left in a good mood as well. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
I never thought about that. I guess that does mean everyone who walks through there has recovered whatever they shot. Like, yeah, they've got it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming to see it.
Yeah, they're happy, telling me stories, showing me pictures. I mean, yeah, it's awesome. It's definitely, hunting community is definitely a brotherhood or a family that it's, I don't think you bond like no other than the hunting community.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Drew. And the one thing, it's always nice to have a relationship with your taxidermist, you know, and I look at my uncles and they have their local taxidermists, and even if we're not gonna keep the cape, you know, they'll cape out animals and bring it into their taxidermist and just say, here you go, you know, and they kind of barter and trade. But it's that community of being able to come in and, you know, you reap what you sow, and you know, you give back a little bit, and you know, it's that bond between everybody. And I think it's great to have, you know, a local guy like you. It's always awesome supporting your community, you know, no matter what the cost is. And so having that relationship with someone who you can trust, who trusts you, and you know, you have that relationship, it's pretty awesome, man. So it's been really fun to hear about what all the things you got going on and where you're at and how you got there. Absolutely, man. And I wish you the best of luck with everything going on, and with all the hunt season coming up, you're going to be a busy man.
I do hope so, man. Yeah, I do appreciate the opportunity to get out here and talk to you guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Heck yeah, man. We'll, you know, we're rolling up in an hour here, but we'll have you back on end of the season. We'll do a little recap, see where you're at. If you've busted out that Osceola, and we'll see where you've gotten, man.
Yeah, but don't hold your breath for that, but yeah, definitely love to follow up for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Bobby, you got any closing thoughts for us?
I mean, I'm glad you jumped on. It was really interesting to see your perspective from, you know, we always don't think about it from your side of it. We just drop it off, pick it up, and then it's on our wall forever. And, you know, and I always forget to mention to, you know, I have a couple different guys around by me. Like you said, you like to do in birds, and I have one guy that refuses deer mounts, and, you know, that's just one thing that he does. And stick with your, just like a tattoo artist, man, you got to find what they're good at and what they want to do. And that's the style you're going for.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Drew, you got any closing thoughts for us, man?
No, man. Like I said, I could go on a soapbox, but yeah, just, I guess just take care of your cape, take care of your duck, pick the right one, make sure it's in good shape, and find a taxidermist that does good work. Don't look at the price, make it worth your while.
That's all good advice, man. Where can listeners go find you on social media, Drew?
Sure. It's Georgia Outdoorsman Taxidermy, Facebook and Instagram. And my website has all the links for it. But yeah, pretty easy to find if you just search Georgia Outdoorsman Taxidermy.
Yeah. Everybody go follow Georgia Outdoorsman Taxidermy. Drew does phenomenal work. And one thing I didn't mention that I wanted to, Drew, is you post a lot of like helpful content, like your how-to videos and things like that, that are helpful for guys like me who stick ducks in freezers for 5 years. So that helpful content is like really beneficial. And it's not just pictures of your work. So yeah, thanks for doing that. And yeah, listeners, go give them a follow. As always, we appreciate the howdy, you guys, and we will talk to you next week.